always seem to go, that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
We could do, there's so much we could know if we listen.
Every day is Earth Day. I'm Ken Gale.
And I'm Donna Stein. And this is Ecologic for September 18th, 2020.
When your air or water is clean, thank an environmentalist. If not, become one. Enough said.
Today's show is the kind of show you will only hear on WBAI. When mainstream media does a tribute to someone, it's usually a celebrity, or a politician, or someone in the public eye. Here at WBAI, we can do tributes to activists, people whose lives were dedicated to helping other people without needing or getting a claim. Today, we're talking about Kevin Zeis. You may not know his name, but you surely know his work.
Our guests today are Margaret Flowers, his partner in all aspects of life, and Tarek Kauf and Ellen Davidson, who knew and worked with Kevin for years. Welcome to Ecologic.
Thank you for having Hello. Me.
Thanks for having us, Ken and Donna.
WBAI is special in doing shows like this, and Kevin was a special person for whom to do a show like this. It was quite important.
And you notice we are talking about Kevin in the past tense. He recently passed, and it's a great loss to everyone who loved him and the issues, the many, many issues that he worked on.
It was a tremendous loss for the planet as well. Mm.
Yes.
Kevin
yeah.
was a force. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, Tarek.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say, Kevin was a force in so many ways for justice and peace on so many different... There was no issue that involved justice or peace or sustainability or the policies against war and destroying the environment that Kevin did not work on and was not instrumental on.
Yeah, if I could just talk a little bit about him, if that would be okay.
Go for it, Margaret.
This is Margaret Flowers, and as you said, Kevin was my partner in all aspects of life. We co-directed Popular Resistance together, which people can still find at popularresistance.org, and had a show on WBAI, Clearing the Fog Radio. But Kevin, really from the beginning, you know, even in high school, he was politically active, fighting the Vietnam War. In college, got involved with the anti-racist protests and, you know, experienced the police violence. He was beaten at a protest in Boston by police on horseback. In law school, he was involved with NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, and his first task for NORML, somebody needs to mute maybe, was answering letters from people in prison because of the drug war. So he learned up close and personal, you know, what people were experiencing, how the drug war devastated their lives and the lives of their families. And so he dedicated himself to that for, you know, 20 years. He was working for Normal as legal counsel and then as the executive director. And then he went on to found the Drug Policy Foundation, and they created something called the Alliance of Reform Organizations, where he brought all of the organizations from across the United States that were working on issues related to the drug war, brought them together and connected them as one movement, because he always understood that our power lied within, you know, bringing people together across issues and working together. And then that work just continued on from there, you know, working on a whole broad range of issues, from environmental issues to economic justice, racial justice, peace. You know, fighting the Trans-Pacific Partnership and stopping that, fighting net neutrality. He was a big advocate for single-payer healthcare, but he was also just somebody that people turned to constantly for assistance, for advice. He was just had a lot of wisdom, a lot of clarity on how power works, and so people would come to him with, you know, for advice on their campaigns or help with devising strategy, and people just really saw him as a mentor. As well, so many people he mentored across the country, because he believed that his task was to create the next generation of leaders. He knew that change was not going to be, you know, we're not going to get to where we want to be in his lifetime. And so you constantly have to cultivate the next wave of resistance and revolutionaries. And so he really dedicated himself to that.
That's very interesting that you, that perspective. That's Pete Seeger from Clearwater was all, for many things, was always saying that thing, that his whole life was dedicated to bring in the new generation of environmentalists and working with young people. So that's an important perspective that all good leaders come to.
And he connected issues. That's one of the things I like most is, you would find him in one area talking about other areas and how they overlapped and how they connected. It's all one enemy. And we have this habit of compartmentalizing things. And I love that Kevin sort of opened those compartments.
Right. Well, he saw, you know, compartmentalization as a tactic used by the power holders to separate us into these little silos and make us weak. And so he really understood very clearly that, you know, what we're talking about, if we're really going for the social transformation we need, it's really getting at the root causes of what's causing the crises that we're facing. And those root causes impact everything. You know, if you look at white supremacy, capitalism, you know, these imperialism, these are really underscoring the crises that we're facing. And so the more that we work together, the more effective we can be. Also, we understood that you're not always going to make progress on one front all the time. And so working on multiple fronts of struggle, you're always pushing forward towards that goal, whether you're pushing on one issue or another issue. It's all about continuing to build that political power, raise awareness, develop national consensus to support the issues that you're fighting for. You know, it was just something he did every day, literally 7 days a week. And he always felt so privileged to be able to do that kind of work, you know, throughout his life and have the ability to dedicate himself to that.
You know, one thing, when I heard that Kevin had passed, the first thing I did was go to my photo archives and put together photos that I had of him. And I was so struck by all of the different issues that we had been at the same event working on, from the TPP to the to Chelsea Manning to the environment. And also, I have pictures from when you and he gave us a tour of the garden that you guys created at your house. And just on that level, on a much more micro, personal level, the pictures of him talking about the plants, and he's looking at the plants with so much love. So on so many different fronts and on so many different levels, he was active.
And can I want to say something that people who worked with Kevin will know this, but not everybody had that great opportunity. Kevin always had a smile. He was always upbeat. You knew if you were working with Kevin, it wasn't a depressed thing. You were happy. He had this great laugh that came from deep inside of him, and he shared that often. He had a great sense of humor, and that means so much to activists to be able to have that joyful sense of humor about everything that we're doing, because it sparks a creativity, and he certainly had that. And everything we did had an element of creativity and humor in it, which is pretty terrific.
And he loved to set people up for success. You know, he would create situations where people would be able to step forward and shine. And, he just really believed in empowering people. And you're right, that optimism, you know, as he understood how difficult the changes that we're fighting for are, but he always believed that people organized could win what we need, you know, what we're fighting for.
We mentioned at the beginning of the show that people may not know his name, but they would know his work. Give us some examples of his work that may have stood out.
Well, you know, one area where Kevin was able to see the fruits of his work is in fighting the drug war. He started in early 1980s trying to get the legalization of medical marijuana. And in fact, in the 1980s, he sued the Drug Enforcement Agency 3 times to reclassify marijuana, you know, in a lower classification so it could be dispensed more easily. And he won each time, but then it got overturned in appeal. So then they had to turn to the state strategy, you know, of trying to get the laws passed at the state level. And so when he was first waging that, the public opinion was very strongly in favor of the drug war. He was fighting on an issue that was not at all popular, but again, he saw how this impacted people's lives, the difference that it made in their health, patients with cancer or glaucoma. And so that didn't, you know, deter him. He even was getting death threats at that time. And so now we see that public opinion has completely changed, that there's legalization of medical marijuana, and in fact, adult recreational use is legal in quite a number of states. And that's a fight that he was very involved in, as well as other aspects of the drug war, mass incarceration, harm reduction. He was a real leader in harm reduction for the drug use. Did someone want to say something?
No, I just blew my nose.
Profound. And also the work on TPP was very important.
That was something that, you know, we found out about early on during the Occupy movement, which the four of us, you know, Tarek and Ellen and Kevin and I were deeply involved in organizing that.
And, as were Ken and I.
And when we learned about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was this huge trade deal being negotiated by the Obama administration in secret, not even members of Congress could read what they were talking about. It was being written by corporate lawyers, and it was a new kind of trade deal because it was actually open. So it was involving 12 countries, but other countries would be able to join onto it once it was passed. And so it could really was going to be have the potential to completely shape world trade in a way that favored the corporations and hindered protection of the planet and protection of workers and human rights. And so when we first took that fight on, we thought, wow, we're going against, you know, Exxon and Walmart and all these giant corporations. But we just worked with many others across the country, but persistently building and connecting the issues so that so many groups understood how this would impact them, until it became, you know, just this wave that the politicians had to, you know, jump on. And so by the end of, you know, 2016 elections, all these politicians who had been in favor of it, including Hillary Clinton, were coming out against it. And that was something that became, you know, politically unfeasible. And so, you know, Trump saw that opportunity and took it and refused to sign the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But that was, you know, it was one of those fights that Kevin just saw as, we may not win, but we have to try. And we were successful, fortunately.
And that was such an Occupy type issue because it involved pretty much every single solitary Occupy working group, because TPP touched on every single issue. So we talked earlier about Kevin making connections between issues. TPP was a natural.
Yeah, it absolutely was. I mean, in terms of healthcare, if the Trans-Pacific Partnership had passed, it would make it very difficult for us to go to a single-payer healthcare system like a Medicare for All. It had all sorts of rules that would protect the pharmaceutical company profits. Yeah. It would, you know, so literally corporations could sue governments if the government passed a law that inhibited them from making profits. So if you pass an environmental law to stop them from polluting, they could sue the government and say you're trying to prevent us from making profits. But the governments couldn't sue the corporations, you know, and they were going to be sued in this corporate tribunal world court that basically is run by corporate lawyers who take leaves from their jobs to serve as the arbitrators. And so it's a very rigged type of system. So it was really going to strip us of the ability for our communities to pass laws to protect workers and protect our health and the planet.
Margaret, and veterans, yeah. Oh, go ahead, Tarek.
Margaret, do you remember, speaking about the TPP, do you remember that action we did when we all wore safety helmets and workers' overalls? What building was that at?
It was the U.S. Trade Representative building, and there was, conveniently, there was some scaffolding on the side of the building, and we went, everybody dressed up as if they were some kind of construction workers, and people climbed up on the side of the building, and we draped that entire building with banners saying, flush the TPP.
And nobody stopped
right, well,
us.
There were secret negotiations going on inside, and we wanted people to be aware of what was happening. We did it right in front of the police, right across the street from the White House at noon on a Monday. It was pretty amazing.
All right.
That's right.
And you remember Kevin got Tig unarrested. He was an excellent negotiator.
Kevin,
police liaison.
Kevin was a great negotiator with the police. He was a lawyer, and he was good. He was really good. And he was a large person. You know, he stood physically, he was large as well as internally, as well as, you know, in other ways. He was a big person, and he had a way of dealing with the police with a smile and a convincing way. And yeah, he got Tig released, which was great.
And Ellen Davidson, who mentioned her photographs, she's got a webpage with pages of photographs of Kevin. And I linked to that from the ecoradio.org webpage. So you can see photographs of Kevin. So if all this sounds familiar, like, oh, I think I met him, look at those photos. And they're wonderful photos. Ellen, you did a wonderful job.
Thank you.
She always does.
Yeah, I treasure those photos.
Yeah. Now, we know that Kevin was working most recently on several projects, and his work is going to go on. Nothing is going to stop the seeds that he's planted. Can you tell us about some of those events that he was planning?
Just in the weeks before his death, we were active in organizing protests around the attack on the postal office. He was really gearing up for he died just the day before Julian Assange's trial began in the United Kingdom. He was very, you know, cared very deeply about that and understood how important this trial is for really setting, you know, for the 21st century what press freedom is going to look like and whether we're going to have the right to know what our government and corporations are doing or whether journalists and publishers around the world are going to be afraid to tell the truth because the U.S. can go after them like they're going after Assange. So he had organized a webinar with Daniel Ellsberg, James Goodale, who was the lawyer for the New York Times during the Pentagon Papers, and Chris Hedges. And so we went ahead and held that webinar anyway, even though Kevin had died. He was very involved in a local campaign in Maryland, but one that actually, you know, has the potential to go nationwide, and that's around the desecration of an African burial ground in Bethesda, Maryland, where they're building a self-storage facility right on top of a African burial ground that was where there was slavery in that area, and there were actually industrial slave breeding operations going on there after the transatlantic slave trade stopped in 1807. Slave owners turned to breeding slaves for sale, a really heinous and awful thing. And around the country, these African cemeteries are marginalized, they're built over, and this community was trying to stop that from happening in their community. So he died early on a Sunday morning. That Thursday night, we had done a training camp with a bunch of young activists, and then on Friday, we were there to support them through the action as they shut down construction at that site. But that's ongoing if people want to check out the Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition. He was also involved in Green Party politics, and Kevin ran for U.S. Senate in Maryland in 2006, and he ran on a carbon-free, nuclear-free economy. This was before people were talking about the Green New Deal, but he believed very strongly, and he worked with Arjan Makajani of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, and who laid out that we could go to carbon-free, nuclear-free. So that was a big part of his platform.
There's another way you're honoring Kevin. Can you tell us a little bit about the Emerging Activist Fund?
Yes. So Kevin has two adult sons, and you know, after his death, people were asking what they could do, and so we got together and talked about it, and decided that the best way to honor Kevin would be to continue his work of supporting the next generation of activists. And so the Kevin's East Emerging Activist Fund, we're hoping to raise so that we can sponsor young activists and mentor them, as well as frontline grassroots organizations that either wouldn't get support or are working on issues that many people don't recognize as being important. You know, just as Kevin recognized the drug war and fought that before it was a popular thing to do, he saw that on so many other issues as well, and he wasn't afraid to jump in there and tell the truth and fight for something, even when other people didn't totally understand what was going on or didn't quite support that yet. So we want to keep that going, and that's being housed on our website, popularresistance.org. So if people go to popularresistance.org, you'll see on the menu where it says Kevin's East Emerging Activist Fund, you'll learn more about that. His sons, you know, like Kevin, they always want to involve everyone, and so they invited other family members to be involved, and so you'll see who's on there.
We're out of time.
Yeah, well, time flew by again. There's always more information than there is time, but no worries, as you can hear more of this discussion on our webpage, ecoradio.com, Adam Weissman.
.org.
Dear. Well, that'll make them remember when you make a mistake, right? Ecoradio.org. And Adam Weissman and Pete Dolak will be joining us. So those of you online, go to ecoradio.org. The full hour will be up in about, we'll join our mailing list and we'll let you know.
Yeah, you can get a variety environmental news on a variety of topics there, including COVID-19, by going to ecoradio.org. You can go to get our after show segments. So we'll let you know when those after show segments are online if you sign our mailing list.
That's www.ecoradio.org. As you know, we have something that belongs to you. This listener-sponsored radio station is yours. Now, we need you to show your responsibility and your love for WBAI Radio and your favorite show, or at least one of them, we hope. That's Ecologic. You have choices on how you can keep us on the air. You can go to www.give2wbai.org website or get one or more of our terrific premiums by putting eco-logic in the search box in the upper right corner. Or what would be much appreciated is for you to become our buddy. Just go to www.give2wbai.org on the BAI Buddy page, and on the drop-down box, click on Ecologic and pledge a monthly amount, any amount. Think of what this show is worth to you. You have our sincere thanks.
And big thanks to our wonderful engineer, Reggie Johnson. We couldn't do this without you. I'm Ken Gale.
And I'm Donna Stein. See you next Friday at 2:30 p.m.
WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Askia Muhammad. Here are some headlines. A federal judge yesterday issued a nationwide injunction to temporarily halt changes to U.S. Postal Service policies that have delayed mail delivery across the country ahead of a presidential election which is predicted to bring in a record number of mail-in ballots. U.S. Judge Stanley Bastian, Chief Judge of the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Washington, found the Postal Service was, quote, involved in a politically motivated attack on the efficiency of the Postal Service, which would irreparably harm the state's ability to administer the 2020 general election. The White House ditched a plan to partner with the Postal Service to send every American a face mask, the Washington Post reported. A draft press release obtained by the Post showed that the Postal Service was preparing to send out 650 million face masks in April to supply every household with them. However, a senior administration official told the Post that the White House nixed the plan because officials thought receiving masks might create concern or panic. President Trump said he would sign an executive order to promote patriotic education through an effort called the 1776 Commission, while denouncing lessons which detail the history of the enslaved Africans. In the speech, Trump decried what he said was a twisted web of lies being taught in classrooms about systemic racism, calling it a form of child abuse. Trump was speaking at the National Archives in Washington.
The left-wing rioting and mayhem are the direct result of decades of left-wing indoctrination in our schools. It's gone on far too long. Our children are instructed from propaganda tracts like those of Howard Zinn that try to make students ashamed of their own history.
Trump was referencing Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. In response, the Zen Education Project tweeted, quote, "So what explains the rebellions in 1676, 1680, 1786, 1831, 1859, and more by Native Americans, enslaved Africans, coal miners, and more? Howard Zinn wasn't born then." Trump also lashed out at the 1619 Project, the Pulitzer Prize-winning series which re-examines the legacy of slavery. On Twitter, 1619 creator Nicole Hannah Jones pointed out, "The White House Conference on American History has not a single black historian on it. Strange." Voting rights advocates announced this week that the Maryland State Board of Education is partnering with nonprofit organizations to expand absentee ballot access to eligible incarcerated voters. Out for Justice says the Board of Elections has committed to sending voting instructions, registration applications, mail-in ballot applications, and prepaid envelopes up to all eligible voters held in local jails. The Department of Labor is reporting another 860,000 workers filed for new unemployment benefits last week. Since the pandemic began, around 60 million jobless claims have been filed. Meanwhile, the total net worth of the nation's billionaires has soared by nearly $850 billion since mid-March, a 29% increase. That's according to a new study by the Institute for Policy Studies. This comes as a new poll conducted by NPR and researchers at Harvard finds economic fallout from the pandemic has hit non-white communities the hardest. clearing and breezy in the DMV this afternoon. Currently in Washington, it's partly cloudy and 70. In New York, it's cloudy and 68. I'm Askia Muhammad. Thank you for listening to WP.